Good evening and welcome to the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, March 24th, 2025. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Two former Democratic congressmen from Idaho hold town hall in Moscow and address the possibility of martial law and how to resist the authoritarian bent of the U.S. government and the Trump Doge administration. Federal judge grants temporary injunction against enforcing Idaho's ban on health of the mother in emergency care in abortion cases. It only applies to St. Luke's. 2,000 take a stand for public lands at Boise rally. And Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston sponsors bill to return 100 pages of Medicaid reimbursement rules to Idaho state code after those rules were stripped by a Medicaid reorganization bill that Governor Brad Little recently signed. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Reports. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The two Democrats who most recently represented Idaho in Congress are Larry LaRocco in District 1 and Richard Stallings in District 2. LaRocco was in Congress until 1995 and Stallings until 1993. That was a long time ago. They both came out of retirement to hold town hall meetings, including one in Moscow Saturday night, in order to help answer the question of how to deal with the authoritarian bent the Trump-Musk administration is on. When asked, Richard Stallings suggested it may take a general strike. Here's Richard Stallings, followed by Larry LaRocco, at Saturday's meeting at the 1912 Center.
You and I alone can do. It's going to take a joint effort. I think at this point, we're still holding. The day Trump defies court orders, then all bets are off, because then the system may not survive. If that happens, I think we should have a massive national strike and just pour in the streets in such numbers that they would be terrified at the results. I think that only by doing that can we show this clown car of officials what the American people really feel like. We've had this system for 250 years. It's worked perfectly, but it's been based on some principles. Equality of people. It's been based on the idea of having pride and shame. This government has none of that.
I don't think that we can necessarily rely on the courts to bail us out of this, okay? We don't know which way that's going. There are a lot of cases before the courts right now that are pushing back on Trump. The other thing is that I think that there are certain themes that you know that will work in your community on issues that are here. For example, if they are crazy enough, delusional enough to close the Social Security office in Lewiston, then I think that there should be people lined up from Moscow to Lewiston down 95 with placards, because this has to be done. And there are the tech bros and the techno-capitalists that are hidden behind the doors of the Doge and so forth. They're making decisions that impact your lives. So that's a local issue that you could really exploit and make a good point. And I wanted to make an aside here. I worked for 6 years for Senator Frank Church with constituent relations. If I knew that in this district and this area, and I was working for Senator Church, and the president was going to close his office, I would be on the phone with Senator Church, and I think I know what he would be doing. He would write a letter to the president of the United States and say, don't close it. So when the mantra comes out, comes out and says, do your job, they're not even doing their job. They're silent, and that really upsets me. The other issue could be public lands. There was a public lands rally down in Boise today, about 2,000 people. And when they want to take, we've been through this before, right, Mark? We've been through this on the Sagebrush Rebellion, and now they're coming back because the techno bros are looking at some algorithm or something and figuring out that they can sell off the public lands, and then they're going to gaslight us and cook the books and say, well, we'll have a savings, and therefore we've done our job. But these are our public lands, and we should maintain those and not sell them off to them. Now, give me this one.
That was former member of Congress Larry LaRocco, preceded by former Congressman Richard Stallings, both Idaho Democrats. There was concern about flunkies from the Trump administration moving towards the privatization of public lands for the benefit of billionaires by gutting the Forest Service, the USDA, and the Interior Department. Here is Larry LaRocco answering a question about that on Saturday night.
Community sense of values about the public lands, just as you prompted us to do. And what I would encourage is after today is that others meet here and do whatever you can to raise the visibility of this thing, because we have fought these fights in the past with the Sagebrush Rebellion where they thought that they could take our lands. But this is serious now because of who's in power and sort of this ideological jihad that's going on now, so that we really need to talk about the values of the public lands and what it means to America, because they want to roll back everything. They want to roll back everything. I have not feared that those boundaries of the River of No Return wilderness that Frank Church got through Congress would be threatened for 1 second until January 20th. I haven't been worried about it because it's a crown jewel of our country. But all the laws that you're talking about now are just subject to being just overridden and so forth, and the departments, and gutting those agencies so that there's nobody out there taking care of the lands. And what we're doing, the reason that the people in McCall, who are an example for us, are out on the streets, is because the people who know the landscape best and may have been seasonal employees and then moved on to be full-time employees were deemed to be probationary. So the very people who knew the landscape were fired. So we're just eating our young in this thing. We can't happen. And so I'm agreeing with you totally, and I just want you all to express your appreciation for these public lands and what's going on. They've already started this in Utah, you know that. Senator Lee has started with the unappropriated lands. And they talked about housing on the public lands, how we just take it away. And the Wilkes brothers want to take over land around McCall and so forth. This is just cuckoo land. I mean, this is crazy. It's chaotic and it's wrong. And it eats at the values of our country and what Teddy Roosevelt said. I had a sign in my office. I took a picture of it because I was on the Interior Committee. And it said, "The nation behaves best when it treats its natural resources as assets to be passed on to the next generation, increased and not impaired in value." And I put that in my office so that every day I could look at that when I went to the Interior Committee, that it gave me a spine to make sure that I was doing the right thing. And we need to instill the same thing in this delegation, because they're not doing their job, and you know where their campaign contributions are coming from, and it's not, believe me, from the Idaho Conservation League or the Sierra Club. So I think this is a salient issue that will bring us together, and I think we need to mobilize people about this, and that's why they were meeting down in Boise. So let's use that as momentum for us to really gather together and protect those public lands. And I think it's a galvanizing issue with independents and people in the middle and Republicans. So let's do that.
That was former member of Congress Larry LaRocco. Moderator Kathy Dawes read a question from the audience about the possibility of martial law. Here's the question, followed by the responses from Richard Stallings and Larry LaRocco.
I'm very fearful that the real purpose of the destabilization of the government and the economy that is happening now is aimed toward declaring a national emergency and declaring martial law to prevent midterm elections. I even think I sound paranoid, but he has already declared an economic emergency and invoked wartime act to do mass deportations. What are the chances of this? Not in a normal world. But is this a current, this is a current Trump world? What are the chances of this?
Good question. I'll tell you what frightens me the most about this whole thing. The way Trump is rounding up these immigrants, these people that came here with the promise that they could have a life here, and by declaring them terrorists, he thinks he can then put them in jail in El Salvador, flying down El Salvador. I mean, that runs counter to everything this country stands for. We are a country that allows due process. Those people should be brought before a judge. If Trump has legitimate issues, lay them before the judge. And if he doesn't, let these people go, because they just want to make a living. They just want to support their families. And I find that repulsive somehow, because they have brown skin. So anyone that's counter to Trump could be Trump. So tomorrow, I speak to the cops and say, you guys are enemies of the state, you're terrorists, because you're stirring up the people in Moscow. What course do we have? Could you lock us up, send us to El Salvador? I mean, we're really treading on some pretty dangerous ground here, because we are a nation of laws, and no one should be above that law. The principle, again, that all people are created equal, I think is absolutely paramount, and we need to fight for it. So, I think that's my response to this. Yeah. Go ahead.
I'm just going to add to that I don't think we are looking at a constitutional crisis. I think we're in a constitutional crisis right now. And when we started the statewide tour a week and a half ago, I maybe wouldn't have said that, but the shock and awe on a daily basis is what is coming at us. And it's coming at us on purpose, because this crew, the 2025 project, believes in the unitary executive theory that all power or greater power exists in the executive branch. And they are trying to push this in any way they can. So the person that asked that question, you're fearful, you showed up today, and I think a lot of people in this room feel that way. I feel that way because I'm scared to death of what's going on with this person, because I think he's delusional, and all of the other problems that he has are just coming to fore. And remember, in the first Trump era, people came in and they left in record time. Now these people have been vetted. They all pledge loyalty to him that he won the 2020 election. So they have to buy into the lie that the election was stolen, and then they get their place on the government. And then you have the Elon Musk threat of primarying people that keeps them in line. So this is why we're here, because this system's not working now. People are not using their voting card, they're not doing their job, and they're being cowed into this authoritarian bent that we're on right now. So the question is not, if that question had been asked a year ago about this country, we would have just poo-pooed that and said, that can't happen in America. But over the last 6 weeks, we have to ask that question, actually. We do. And if we ask the question, and we come up with the answer that we all know, then we have to do something about it.
But it's not a question. He's already done it. He's deported people illegally against federal court orders.
Everybody go to the microphone. But I heard you. And, I know it was heartfelt. And you're correct.
former Democratic U.S. Representative from Idaho's 1st Congressional District, Larry LaRocco, preceded by former Democratic U.S. Representative from Idaho's 2nd Congressional District, Richard Stallings. The two retired Democrats held a town hall meeting at the 1912 Center in Moscow Saturday night. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by listeners like you. And by
Letaw Wildlife Association, encouraging hunters to use lead-free ammunition for the benefit of their families, predators, scavengers, and the environment. Available online at facebook.com/Letaw Wildlife Association. For information on becoming a KRFP underwriter, go to krfp.org and click Support KRFP.
Don't touch that dial. You got it right.
We're up in the morning when it first gets light, and we do it all day. Then we're up all night so you can listen to the radio.
You got it right.
You listen to the radio. You've got it right.
Listen, listen, anytime you listen, everybody's on a mission, and there ain't nothing missing when you listen to the radio.
Listen to the radio.
You've got it right.
Community radio.
Listen, and you give a little listen to the radio.
Radio Free Moscow.
Fight Back Radio. It's 90.3 on your radio dial. Fight Back.
Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for your support. So keep on listening, and listen, and listen, and listen.
Fight Back.
See y'all around.
We're still here.
Radio.
Still here.
Fight Back.
Fight Back.
Fight
Back.
Fight Back.
Fight
Back.
Fight Back.
Fight Back.
And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report. Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston has proposed a bill to return the hundreds of pages of Medicaid reimbursement rules that a recently passed bill from Republican Representative Jordan Redman of Coeur d'Alene eliminated. Governor Brad Little signed House Bill 345 this month, moving the entire Medicaid program in Idaho to a third-party managed care organization. The bill also creates a work requirement for many Medicaid recipients, among other things, and eliminates the reimbursement rules, which supporters say took over 20 years to develop. McCann spoke about the importance of the Medicaid reimbursement rules at a Coffee with the Legislators town hall meeting at the Moscow Chamber of Commerce office Saturday morning.
I don't think some people even really realize what those rules were. But all the rules that were deleted at the end of that bill were dealing with home and community health services, the disabled folks. And so I don't know if any of you know Hannah Litke. She's a county commissioner, also runs Opportunities Unlimited in Lewiston. And so she called me, and I was coming to Boise. So we sat down and we discussed where she saw all these flaws in the bill. There's been some discussion on whether that bill has taken effect immediately upon signature. Does it not take effect till July 1? Because if it takes effect immediately, then there are no rules by which you are bound by or following. So that is right now in the works, and I'm working on it with health and welfare folks and the governor's office to say, where are we? What do we need to do? But I have legislation. Hannah and I went to the Legislative Services Office, and they drafted us a bill to add back in those rules. I was told by the Health and Welfare Department their plan is they have temporary rules ready to go and ready to take effect on May 1. And we are trying to wrap up, but I just said we're going to get this bill at least in play to kind of say these are problems that we're hearing about. So we are working on it. But there'll be a third party administering and sending out all the checks to the providers instead of the Department of Health and Welfare. So I don't know what the percentage will be of the total amount, but I'm sure it'll be a good chunk of money that'll go to that third party. And that was my question is, can you tell me how much you think the state will actually save? But that's kind of an unknown almost. And other states that have gone to managed care, there are, I guess you would say the jury's out on whether it's really been a good plan.
That was Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston at a coffee with the legislators meeting in Moscow Saturday. The other two legislators from District 6, Senator Dan Foreman of Moscow and Representative Brandon Mitchell of Moscow, did not attend. At the meeting, there was concern about the powerful Joint Finance Appropriations Committee slashing budgets. Representative McCann said lawmakers on JFAC may not approve the enhanced budget for Idaho's universities or might cut the University of Idaho's budget by $10 million.
Did hear a disturbing possibility about higher education because we've passed, you know, the maintenance budget, so to speak, but there are enhancement budgets that are really becoming the challenge. And so I was even told on Friday there's a chance that they won't even take up the enhancements for our universities.
What?
And because they're afraid they can't get them across the floor. And just say they have to, the maintenance budgets keep the lights on, and that's all we're going to do this year. So contact your JFAC members and talk about that if you're really passionate about it. But I don't even know exactly what's in the enhancement budgets. I was concerned. I said, what about their permanent building fund? Well, that's a separate budget, so they think that one will be okay. But so, but I am concerned. I don't know if they can survive with those cuts. If they don't do anything, does that mean that next year their budgets are cut more? I had heard that they were going to cut about $10 million out of the U of I's budget and $5 million out of BSU's budget, but then I heard maybe they won't take that up at all.
A lot of the work remaining in the waning weeks of the legislative session involves passing budgets for various state departments and programs. McCann spoke about the difficulty for her and her fellow legislators to get the budgets passed and the influence of the far-right Idaho Freedom Foundation with its rating system for legislators based on their votes on issues important to the far right.
We are watching that leadership is not supporting these budgets. And these budgets are marked negative, some of them -4, -3 from the Freedom Foundation. I don't look at that, but a lot of legislators do. And when they're negative, you can watch the board and you can see who's going to vote or not vote. So a group of us said, we're tired of taking the hit. We're tired of us saying we're going to get these budgets passed because we need to get these budgets passed. And I do appreciate the hard work that they do in JFAC. And every time that a budget goes down, it's about another 5-6 days before you can get those budgets back. But I voted against the two. One was a health and welfare budget, and the other one was a budget that had a whole lot of different agencies in it. But the only reason, and it wasn't because I felt that they were not being fiscally responsible, because I do really have a lot of faith in my JFAC colleagues, that they spend a ton of time and they have been trying to cut budgets. But by golly, I went to the speaker afterwards and I said, Speaker, you see what happened. We are looking at what you're doing and what leadership is doing. And if you can't support these budgets, then why are you putting it on the backs of those of us who are supporting to get these budgets over? And I said, is it because you guys want a better score on your free or your spending score? What's the reason? And no, I didn't like that budget. And I said, okay, you know, that's fine, but
why?
But you guys are all going down on a lot of budgets. You will watch. And so the group of us that keep voting yes decided, by golly, no, we're gonna take a stand and say, we need to get together here in this House, and if we're going to vote them down, I guess then we vote them down, but then let's talk about what is the reason we're voting these down, and that's why I voted against those two. But I have been voting for most all the budgets. I don't think I've voted against any other ones, Marty, and because I think that they are whittling away. They're trying to make those budgets smaller, but I'll be beat up because I do vote for the budgets.
That was Republican Representative Lori McCann of Lewiston, who represents District 6. KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox assisted with this story. The U.S. District Court Judge B. Lynn Windmill granted a preliminary injunction Thursday against Idaho's trigger abortion law that would prevent emergency room doctors from performing an abortion to save the health of the mother, only to save the life of the mother. The decision comes in a lawsuit that St. Luke's Health System filed in January against Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador. The lawsuit was filed January 14th. The Trump administration recently withdrew their lawsuit against the same Idaho law that the Biden administration filed in 2022, which the U.S. Supreme Court had booted back to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in June of last year. Judge Windmill's preliminary injunction only applies to St. Luke's Health System because the hospital system was the only litigant. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, St. Luke's operates 8 out of Idaho's 39 hospitals and delivered 40% of the 22,000 babies born in the state in 2024. The Biden administration had said in their lawsuit the Idaho Defense of Life Act violates the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, also known as EMTALA, which requires Medicare-funded hospitals to stabilize patients in emergency medical situations. St. Luke's made the same claim in their lawsuit. A St. Luke's court filing said St. Luke's providers once again immediately be subject to the threat of arrest, imprisonment, criminal liability, and loss of license for providing federally required care, and St. Luke's will immediately be at risk of losing its Medicare funding and facing civil litigation and liability. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Jim Woodward of Sagal has introduced a bill in the Senate State Affairs Committee to create a health of the mother exception for emergency doctors who need to perform an abortion. Idaho's extreme abortion law only allows an exception to save the life of the mother. Woodward's bill would make a carve-out for an abortion, quote, to prevent a serious health risk to the mother, unquote, and to provide an abortion to women whose fetus, quote, was diagnosed with a lethal fetal anomaly. Medical providers say the wording of the current Idaho law does not make it clear if physicians can provide an abortion to prevent detrimental health outcomes such as preeclampsia, hemorrhaging, or loss of future fertility. Because of the law, Idaho lost 22% of its OBGYN workforce and more than half of the specialists that deal with high-risk pregnancies in the 15 months after Idaho's trigger abortion law went into effect after the 2022 U.S. Supreme Court Dobbs decision. The committee voted to introduce the bill, but Senate Majority Leader Lori Den Hartog blocked it from moving forward to a full public committee hearing. The Idaho Capital Sun quoted Senator Den Hartog telling the State Affairs Committee, "I'm okay with introducing this legislation to have it out for public consumption, understanding that we're not planning on moving forward with the public hearing this year. I think this is an important conversation. I have many serious and grave concerns with the legislation as drafted." Den Hartog did not say what those grave concerns were. The Idaho Senate voted 28-6 Monday for a new indecent exposure law that would make it a misdemeanor to expose developed female breasts, expose adult male breasts that have been medically or hormonally altered to appear like female breasts, or to expose artificial breasts intended to resemble female breasts. The bill from Republican Representative Jeff Cornelis of Nampa now goes to Governor Brad Little's desk. The bill also bans the showing of toys or products intended to resemble male or female genitals. Unlike another indecency bill that was before the legislature this year that outlaws exposures in public places or where minors are present, Cornelis's bill says showing of the aforementioned things would be a misdemeanor anywhere another person is present. The Idaho Senate last week passed a joint memorial calling for the state to take control of the Camas National Wildlife Refuge. The joint memorial from Republican Senator Van Burtenshaw of Territon passed by voice vote. The memorial also calls for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to promptly process a Section 404 permit application for Camas Creek within the refuge. Section 404 of the Federal Clean Water Act requires a permit before dredged or fill material may be discharged into waters of the United States, including wetlands. The Idaho Conservation League says they oppose the joint memorial. The organization released a statement saying, "The Idaho Conservation League strongly opposes SJM 104 because it seeks to strip federally managed public lands from public ownership and place them under state control, specifically under the authority of the Idaho Department of Fish and Game. Another major concern is that the Shoshone-Bannock tribes have reserved treaty rights on those lands, rights that would be lost if the refuge were transferred to the state." As the Trump administration moves to make massive cuts to the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Interior Department, which manage most of the federal government's lands, about 2,000 people showed up for a public lands in public hands rally at the state capitol in Boise on Saturday.
Being here today, I know more than ever that we are here to stand up for the rights of every American to access the beauty and benefits of our public lands, the truest and fairest gems in Idaho. We are here to make sure that future generations know the joy of hiking through a national park, of camping under a starry sky, of watching a bald eagle soar above the mountains, or simply taking a deep breath of fresh, clean air in the middle of a forest.
Some of those who attended the rally arrived on horseback, some with pack mules. In a press conference before the rally, Idaho Conservation League Government Relations Director Jonathan Oppenheimer said it could be devastating if the federal government were to cede their lands to the state. Oppenheimer said if the state had to take over wildfire management, it would bankrupt the state. KRFP citizen journalist Rhea Kumar spoke with John Bengtson of Conservation Voters of Idaho, who is one of the main organizers of the rally.
We held the event because we want to demonstrate to both the powers that be, our elected officials and folks in power, as well as average Idahoans, that this is an issue that we can all agree on, and that this is our shared legacy, the stuff that we inherited from our past generations, and something that we can all agree should stay in public hands.
Why do you think this is so special for Idaho?
So Idaho has the second or third, but I believe second highest share of federal land or federally managed land of any state. It's all around us. It's the foothills that are right over there, but it's also the Owyhee Desert. It's the Frank Church. And it's why a lot of us either move here or choose to stay here. It is central to what it means to be an Idahoan. It simply would not be the same place if we didn't have the foothills to go hike in, or the Middle Fork of the Salmon to spend time on in the summer months.
Are you an Idahoan?
I grew up in Connecticut, but I moved here 10 years ago.
And I'm guessing this is part of a big reason, considering you're working for a conservation group, of why you choose to stay in Idaho.
Yeah, so the last 10 years I've been working for environmental education organizations, so Knowles and Alzar School and a handful of other places. And that's given me the chance to work on these lands and take young people into these places. My driving force is having seen this story over and over again of people, young people in particular, coming into wild places and just literally being transformed. It makes people kinder. It makes people more confident in themselves. It makes people more willing to work together. And And I think it's a magical, magical thing that we have, and I want more people to be able to experience those things.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that keeping lands public is a huge part of making lands accessible to people.
Absolutely, yeah. So so the land that I worked on as an educator is all public land. It's all federally managed and owned by all Americans. And I do not have the same degree of confidence in the state government to manage lands to where we all have access to them. And that's not a comment on the state's ability to do that, but rather a comment on their incentives. So the state is mandated to make money on that land. And that is awesome because that is the money that funds our schools. But they're fundamentally different different incentives, and we know that the state has on the record said that they cannot manage all of the land if they were to take that over, and that that they have sold approximately a third of all the land they've ever been entrusted with. Again, that's not a comment on the state's ability to manage lands, but rather that those are different purposes. And we know that the folks that are advocating for state transfer are seeing that as an opportunity to use and manage land in different ways than the federal government would. And our point is that we trust the federal government not only to continue to manage lands in the ways that we appreciate, but also to include more voices in that conversation so that we can continue to recreate, to have productive agriculture in places where that's appropriate, rather than to rope that off for private interests.
And do you feel like the federal agencies are best fit for the job?
I mean, I think that the federal agencies that manage our public lands have a huge number of competing voices that they have to include in the conversation and ultimately try to make happy. And that is a really challenging job that they are doing their absolute best with, given the resources that they have. I think the answer to that is not to strip away the number of people that are able to help manage that land. The answer is to bring more people to the table so that we can come to the best conclusion possible. I won't say that federal land management agencies get it right all the time, but I think that they are our best starting point for a managing lands in a way that works for everyone.
Yeah, and you did mention kind of bringing everyone to the table and getting broad support for public lands. Do you feel like that broad support is there? Do you feel like most people do support the idea of having federally managed public lands?
Absolutely. My first week in this job, I ended up at a luncheon with the Idaho Efforts and Guides Association. It was a legislative reception. And this was an event where there was lawmakers from all sides of the aisle, people that I knew that I disagreed with on most issues. But the one thing that we could agree on was the fact that public lands are great. They are wonderful. They are a huge part of why we all choose to either stay here or move here. I think that public lands are a great entry point to having a conversation around our shared resources and how we work together to manage those shared resources. And I know that from conversations. I know that from the stickers that I see on bumpers that are keep lands in public hands, and a bevy of other things that I disagree with. And the cool thing is we also have polling data to back that up. So the Colorado College Survey of the West comes out every year and consistently shows that somewhere between 65 and 80% of Idahoans, but also people across the West, are in support of public lands and in support of the land management agencies that help to steward those lands.
I think the National Park Service might be the most popular public or federal agency, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Thank you for yes, absolutely. So it's that, it's the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Forest Service, even the BLM. The reason why it's not as popular as the other ones is that it's just not as well known. But yeah, all of those agencies routinely get 80+ percent approval ratings.
Do you feel like a lot of people understand that they have like a stake in this, that they are public landowners? And I suppose it's more of a question of do you feel like a lot of people are aware and educated about the issue of public lands right now?
I think that there is broad agreement that we want to have open spaces that are open for recreation, for camping, for fishing, for hunting. And then because folks are not as clued into how those lands are managed, because the mark of a good management is being able to go unnoticed, I think that a lot of people do not know either the specifics of how that land is managed, what the management goals are, and then what the proposals are to change that management. We know that there is a huge recognition that the National Park Service, for example, is an important part of American heritage. But as you get into less intensively used lands, you get a lower degree of recognition of what those agencies do. And that's our job, is to educate people about not only what these land management agencies do, what their goals and parameters are, but then also what are the threats that are coming up against them.
That was John Bengtson of Conservation Voters of Idaho speaking with KRFP citizen journalist Rhea Kumar at a Saturday rally for public lands in Boise. About 2,000 people showed up at the state capitol.
Months after the nation's highest court declined to hear a Utah case about ownership of public lands, a Montana House committee will debate whether to support it. The Committee on Energy, Technology, and Federal Relations is scheduled to hear a resolution today about supporting Utah in its 2024 lawsuit against the United States. Utah claimed it's been deprived of sovereign powers because of the federal government's indefinite retention of unappropriated public lands there. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the case in January, but the suit could be refiled. Kirsten Cook of Montana Conservation Voters says that could set what she calls a dangerous precedent.
The state of Montana showing support for such a motion is just a blatant slap in the face to public land owners and lovers.
The federal government owns nearly 70% of the land within Utah's borders and 30% in Montana's. Still, 68% of Montana voters have said they oppose giving states control over national public lands, according to the latest poll. Montana Conservation Voters collected over 1,000 signatures asking state lawmakers to denounce Utah's efforts. Cook says people want to make their voices heard.
People who use our public lands for recreation, hunting, fishing, hiking, for agriculture, for ranching, this in some way, shape, or form would impact a majority of Montanans.
The same committee on Tuesday will hear Senate Joint Resolution 14, which would release federal wilderness study areas from their protected status across more than 1 million acres of Montana public lands, opening them to multiple uses, including agriculture, timber, and mining. I'm Kathleen Shannon with Big Sky Connection.
In the face of the severe effects of climate change across the country, new research offers a framework for how to measure Washington's climate resilience. The research supports Washington's climate resilience strategy, which was published last year. Carly Stowe with the University of Washington's Climate Impacts Group is a lead author on the paper. She says building resilience is critical in order to minimize impacts from droughts, fires, and other extreme weather events.
As the government is investing in resilience, we want to make sure that we're spending that money wisely, and that the programs and activities we're investing in are resulting in increased resilience.
Stowe says the research compares Washington's and South Carolina's approaches to climate preparedness to serve as a guide for other states. She adds the research is one way to demonstrate Washington's leadership in this area, as taking these kinds of measurements is a new practice at the state level. Stowe says measuring climate resilience means incorporating data from dozens of sources across communities, infrastructure, land, and governance. It includes air quality levels, damage to infrastructure, and evacuations in extreme events like floods or wildfires. She says it was helpful to partner with South Carolina on this research, even though each state ended up with a different measurement framework.
There's a lot more that we can learn together. And so continuing partnerships like this, I think, is really important for further building resilience across our country.
Stowe says the Washington State Department of Ecology will be implementing these plans, and the public will start seeing initial results of the measurements in September. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
And that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, 40% chance of showers tonight, mainly before 8 p.m., partly cloudy, low 43. Mostly sunny tomorrow, high 68. Partly cloudy Tuesday night, low 46. Mostly sunny, high 73 on Wednesday. 30% chance of showers and thunderstorm on Wednesday night. Then a chance of showers after midnight, mostly cloudy, low 47. And showers on Thursday, 90% chance, mainly in the afternoon, high 55. Currently 55 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. You can check on the KRFP.org website for more ways to help KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Rhea Kumar and Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Flashpoints is up next. Music begins in earnest at 7:30 with Spotlight with Bex. So stay tuned.
Extinction Rebellion Palouse proudly supports KRFP. XR Palouse is organizing to have our governments and institutions declare a climate emergency, achieve climate justice and biodiversity, and leverage the power of arts and humanities to foster social change. KRFP is dedicated to progressive values, including justice and multiculturalism.